Compton scattering. So if you remember, we had a situation where we have a photon, which interacts with essentially a free electron. And in many cases, the electron is essentially stationary, so its energy is a stress energy. And we have a scattering here where we have an outgoing photon with energy E gamma prime, which equals H nu prime, and an electron with energy E sub E. This angle for the electron with respect to the initial photon direction is phi, and the angle of the outgoing photon with respect to the initial photon direction is theta. Now, this is in the lab frame, okay? So this is in the lab frame. And I had started, I had reviewed some of the properties you can use conservation of energy or momentum to get expressions for the change in wavelength of the photon, I won't write those back down, or the angle of the scattered electron, cosine phi. Okay, so I'll leave that for now, and I'll continue with a few other things. So one of the things that's useful to think about is the angular distribution of the photons. Okay, so this is one of these equations. I think it was one of the early quantum electrodynamics equations that was done and well understood. So it is called the Klein-Nishinya relation. It's relatively complicated. So in terms of theta, the angle to the outgoing photon okay, so I won't read it all, but it has basically 1 half times the electron radius squared. And then you have this initial term that has 1 plus cosine squared of theta in it. This might look familiar to you from a classical perspective. We'll talk about that in a second. And then it has in the denominator this other term that has this parameter epsilon in it. And what epsilon in is essentially a normalized parameter, which is the photon energy, the initial photon energy divided by the mass of the electron times c squared. Okay. So you have this parameter, and then you have in these curly brackets a whole other term which has a 1, but then it has a second term which goes as epsilon squared. Okay, with these other parameters. Now, the thing to note here so what ends up happening is that this expression is called the Klein-Nishinya formula, and it describes the angular distribution of the photons coming out of Compton scattering. What's interesting about this is if you take the classical limit, in the classical limit, Planck's constant goes to zero. Okay? If Planck's constant goes to zero, well, this epsilon is really h nu over mc squared. So that means that epsilon is going to go to zero. And if I were to simplify this, all of this goes to zero, and this term here also goes to zero. So in this case, classically, what we see is that the differential cross-section just in this case would solve to r squared over 2 times 1 plus cosine squared of theta, which is really the same as what you would get classically if you were to look at the distribution of these photons. You'd get a something proportional 1 minus cosine squared of theta. And what's important here is that all of the dependence on the frequency of the photon goes away. Okay. And that's important because classically in Maxwell's equations, you don't have that. The energy and power and everything like that doesn't depend on the frequency of a photon. It depends on just the strength of the electric field. And so you get an expression that looks like that. Okay? So this is the angular distribution of the photons. It's, as I said, a fairly complicated expression. What's good about this is you can, well, we won't do it, but you can take that expression and you can integrate it to get the total cross-section of the Compton scattering. Okay, so this is going to be another lengthy expression. But again, the reason to look at these is to get a sense for what they do when you go to high energy or not so high energy and that sort of thing. So let me just write that down. So the total cross-section, Compton cross-section, for the photon to interact with one electron. Okay, now an atom may have multiple electrons, so we may have to add up the contributions for all of those electrons. But just to interact in the case of one electron, it's 2 pi times the electron radius squared. And then it has several terms, and I'm going to use this epsilon parameter that I defined because it just makes it easier to write. Tell you where I'm getting this here in a second. This takes a while to write it down. Okay. So it's a pretty complicated function of this epsilon parameter. Remember that epsilon is essentially the normalized energy of the incident photon. Okay? You have this term here that's in curly brackets. It has, depending on how big epsilon is, it has a term that is decreasing with epsilon, either as 1 over e epsilon squared or 1 over epsilon. Then you have this term that has 1 over epsilon, and then there's a logarithmic term, and then you have this term that goes down for high epsilon approximately as 1 over epsilon. So there's really only two terms that increase, there's this term that has a logarithm and a 1 over epsilon, and this logarithm has a 1 over epsilon squared, or actually cubed. So the term that goes up the most is this term right here, right? And this really is just sort of taking this distribution, this equation, and going through the integration, all right? Now, I'll just warn you, because the books, neither of the two books or even the others in the list, they all kind of jump around. So to give you a more complete picture of each of the pieces, I've tried to put them together. So I'm going to get this backwards, but just so when you go back and read again, if I recall, this one is in Fernow, this one is in Gruppen and Schwarz, okay? And when I talk about the Compton Edge, that's actually in Leo, which is one of the backup supplemental books. But these are all things that you want to have heard about. So, so this is the cross-section, and as I said, if you were to go up to very high energy, what would end up happening is a lot of these terms would drop out, and you'd end up with, so at high energy, what you would end up with is pi r sub e squared times 1 over epsilon log of 1 plus 2 epsilon cos. So this goes, well, the logarithm doesn't change very much. So this really goes, is approximately proportional to 1 over epsilon. Okay, that's the fastest increasing term. It's not even increasing. On average, it's going down. But it is the least rapidly decreasing term in the whole expression. Okay? So what you can expect is at high energy, the Compton cross-section will fall roughly as 1 over so roughly as 1 over E. And so you can see at high energy, you start to have these falling cross-sections. These are the two, this mu CA and mu CS. These are the mass attenuation for the two Compton components. But you see at high energy, they both fall off. And it's approximately as 1 over the energy of the photon. Okay? Now they go up for lower energies. And you'd want to, you know, this is, as I said, it's a fairly complicated function, and you'd try it. Each one of these pieces is normalized to the mass, the rest energy of the electron, and so there's a period where they rise, and there's a period where they start to fall. Okay? Okay. The other thing is that this cross-section, the cross-section for an atom, is equal to the number of electrons times the cross-section for each electron. So the important thing to note here is that the Compton cross-section goes up with the z of the material, the number of electrons, about linearly, and it goes down approximately as the inverse of the photon energy that you're dealing with. Okay? So those are two important properties. And this here is a useful expression to know. And I'll give some other simplified expressions as we go. But, okay? In general, you won't be using this, but this is really where everything comes from.
So we're just
ignoring
the contraction from the
say it again?
Okay. Yeah, this formula,
which one? This one or this one?
Last one.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think about, I just wonder if there is a Compton scattering between the photon and the nucleon.
Well, the Compton scattering, can I erase the Klein-Nishina formula?
Okay. Is it just about mass?
No, in the Compton, okay, so in the Compton case, let me think a little more carefully about your question. This is a little different process than, for instance, when we talked about photoelectric effect. There you needed a nucleus to allow conservation of momentum. So there was an interaction with the nucleus. Here, the electron is essentially a free electron. And we don't have to be interacting with the nucleus. Perhaps I can interpret your question, though, a little differently, is couldn't I have this kind of drawing? I mean, the drawing is basically, in terms of a Feynman diagram, Okay, so instead of having an electron here, couldn't I have a nucleus? Or let's say it's a hydrogen atom, couldn't this be a proton? Okay. I think the thing there, I mean, a lot of times when we're dealing with this, we're dealing with solid materials, and it may be that the nucleus isn't going to go anywhere. I think the other thing is you're going to have a mass effect, that you're not going to get a lot of very high energy protons out of that, usually. This one here.
Yeah, last one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this one here?
Yeah, the last one. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there is this neutral atom, which has that number of electrons.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just considering the Compton effect.
That's right. That's right. You're only, this is only...
They are bonded.
Well, they are, but, you know, I mean, if you've got a, I don't know, if you've got a 1 MeV photon... and a 10 eV electron, I mean, that's its kinetic energy, that's when it's bound, it has almost no energy compared to the photon. So it's just a free electron, okay? So, I mean, it is possible certainly for a photon to come in and transfer momentum in such a way that it moves a particular nucleus. When we talk actually about nuclear processes, we may come into this a little bit more, but the nucleus is a much more complicated, it's a composite object, it's more complicated. Really, these expressions are only valid in the case where you're talking about a photon scattering in an electron, and the electron can be considered essentially as a free particle, okay? Okay. All right. Okay. So that brings me to. I'll get to that in a second. Okay. So we can also. Think about this from the point of view of what does the energy of the electron look like. And it turns out kinematically there's a constraint on the electron's energy, but we can talk about the differential cross-section with respect to the final electron energy. And this also comes from the Klein-Nishina formula. Okay, so as a reminder, H nu is the initial energy of the photon in this interaction. Epsilon is still the same value before. Epsilon equals H nu over mc squared. And so, and E sub E is the electron energy. Okay? So, this is just the spectrum. It's sort of the histogram of the electron. And what it actually looks like, this is just using this expression, is this. Okay? So this is actually giving for three different photon energies, for 0.5, 1, and 1.5 MeV. And in general, what you can see is that it falls for a little ways, and then it very quickly rises up as a function of energy until some specific value, and then that's it. So you get no cross-section past that point. So you get no electrons past that point. Why is it? Physically or mathematically? Yeah. I have to think about that in terms of electron energy. That's a good question. I have to... No, that's a good question. So, I have to think about it. It's a little too complicated. And I don't have an easy physical way to think about it. It's a good question. It's a kind of thing that you want to have, actually. That will be more important than remembering the exact shape of the curve, obviously. I mean, mathematically, it's a consequence of this, but why it has a specific shape, I can't think about it in terms of physically. Okay, so maybe I'll come back to that next time, but the point here, one of the points that I wanted to make, is that there is a hard edge that actually does come up in some cases. One of the cases that it comes up is actually in some kinds of astrophysical. A lot of the things that we're learning about in this course are used or applicable in high energy astrophysics or particle astrophysics topics. I mean, depending on where you guys go after you leave SMU, you might even end up on experiments like that. And so there are definite cutoffs to the electron spectrum. And it indirectly tells you something about the photon spectrum that initiated it. You can see that this edge is linearly, its position is linearly related to the photon's energy that created that Compton electron. Okay? So that's important. You can, if you see such an edge, if you think it's a Compton edge, you can do something with that. So... And the other thing you can see is it doesn't go all the way up to the actual photon energy. So the electron goes up to, say, 350 keV when the photon was 500 keV. Okay? Okay, actually, let me write down your question. And I can follow that up. Okay. That's good. Any other questions so far? No? Yes? Okay. So the next thing that I wanted to bring up was essentially the loss of energy by the photon. And in particular, I mean, I've already alluded to it a little bit. You can see that you have these two cross-sections here and here. And the reason is because what's happening is the photon is interacting with the material, and it is essentially at that energy, it's disappearing. Okay? It may still continue through the scattering and come out, but we could talk about the Compton cross-section in terms of a scattering component and an absorption component, because it basically the photon is disappearing. So first, what we need to do is write down the ratio of the final photon energy to the initial photon energy. And it turns out that this is a fairly simple function of the photon angle, theta, okay, so this ratio is just 1 plus this term here. It's a function of cosine of theta. And this is a way, this parameter helps one distinguish between the absorption and scattering components of the Compton cross-section. So the total Compton cross-section is equal to the way that it was written there, the scattering component plus an absorption component. And the absorption component okay, so the scattering component could be rewritten as this parameter. I won't rewrite it at length. Times the total cross section. So it's just normalized by the photon, the final photon energy divided by the initial photon energy times the total cross section, plus the absorption component. So this is a more complicated function, but since these two things are summed, and we already know this, again, I won't write it all the way out, but you can calculate what the absorption cross-section is merely by taking this difference. Okay? So, again, these two pieces added together give us the overall cross-section. But by distinguishing them, we can actually see that they both have a fairly different shape. They were on the first plot that I showed as well. They have a similar structure, but the absorption cross-section is significant at higher energies than the scattering cross-section. It's really just a reflection of the fact that when I have a photon, it will, and if I look at the photon and I consider what happens in that energy bin, when it's very high energy, those photons can only lose energy to the electrons, so there's an absorption going on. So at high energy, you will see that the absorption process dominates, and at low energy, the scattering process dominates. Okay? And you can use, I've written down the total Compton cross-section, so if you needed to, you could go through and calculate this. And different books write it, they're similarly long expressions, different books write it a little bit differently. I myself am not overly concerned about the specific structure. The point is that you know that those two processes are happening and what they are, okay? And how they're related to each other. And, okay, so I think that was all I wanted to say about Compton. There is one other thing I do want to say, which is, and this again comes up in high energy astrophysics cases, or cosmic ray, which again, the whole field of cosmic ray physics is really the birth of particle physics, and it's very much part of particle physics. But for instance, we're talking about a situation where you have a photon hitting an electron, and then you have a photon and an electron. But you can actually have a situation where I have a X-ray photon in space. It may be emitted by some galactic object, a supernova, it could, you know, anything. And we have a fairly low energy electron moving along. And then what happens is some sort of scattering. Of the electron off of the photon, okay? And this is a way, basically, this electron would be generally lower energy than this photon, which is also the case in the situation we're talking about. But we're actually thinking about it from the point of view of the photons just out in space. We have it could even be microwave, but then it wouldn't be higher energy. But, and the electron is colliding with it, and there's a scattering. And this is a way that you can give a significant amount of energy to electrons in space. And it's called inverse Compton scattering. So I don't want to be a botanist. I don't want to go into just giving you more and more terminology and just a laundry list, but it is important to know about that it's fundamentally connected to the Compton scattering you're used to, and it's the same reason that I bring up the issue of the Compton edge. These things do come up, and it's good for you to have heard about them. I hope that you remember them and whatever, because they can come up, okay? So that's Compton scattering. That's really all I wanted to say. It's not of major importance, except for a fairly range in terms of the lab, except in terms of a fairly narrow range of energies of a few hundred keV to a few MeV, or maybe tens of MeV. And then it gets swamped by pair production, okay, which is what I want to concentrate on now. Okay. If I don't completely misplace all of my papers. Okay. All right. So let's move on to pair production. So in pair production, is actually very similar to a process that we've already talked about, which is Bremsstrahlung. But let's take a photon that's traveling, and it's going to pass through some medium, and it's going to, there's going to be an electromagnetic interaction. And what in fact happens at some point is that it passes near enough to a nucleus. The main reason it's a nucleus is sort of the same reason that it's a nucleus in Bremsstrahlung. It's because the nucleus is electromagnetically, if you're far enough away, it's essentially a point charge with many times an electron charge. So it's significant. And in any case, so you come by, you have a photon, and what happens is, if I were to draw this in terms of a Feynman diagram, now I haven't lined up. God. So what happens here is I have a positron, an electron, a photon, and this here is a virtual photon. So there's an exchange, there's an interaction between a backward-moving an electron, a positron, and a virtual photon. So this interaction is with the nucleus, and there's an outgoing electron. So from our point of view, what it looks like is a photon produces a E plus E minus pair. Okay, a photon goes in, an electron and a positron come out. So that's what we see. Any momentum exchange with the nucleus is not really important. The nucleus pretty much stays where it is. Now, this is very much like Bremsstrahlung because of the fact that what's going on in Bremsstrahlung is you're switching these two legs. So you're ending up with this. So you have an electron coming in. There's a Brem. There's a Bremsstrahlung photon. It's an interaction with the nucleus, and the electron goes on, but it's lost some of its energy to a photon. Having done this, the theorists, having done this, this then becomes very straightforward because all of the matrix elements, the whole aspect of this calculation is very much the same as this calculation. And in fact, what we'll see is that the properties of this calculation strongly correlate to the properties of this calculation, even though they kind of look completely different, because in this case, we start out with an electron, and we end up with an electron and a photon. And here we start with a photon, and we end up with a positron and an electron. But again, at the Feynman diagram level, they just have this swap going on. Okay? What's most important about this is actually things that are, things that are related to how the cross-section for this process, pair production, varies with the energy of the photon. So that will turn out to look fairly familiar to what you see with electrons. And it's the characteristic size of the cross-section and the distance over which it occurs will also reproduce at some level what happens with Bremsstrahlung. Okay? But this is very important, and it has a huge impact on how we build things and how we build detectors and calibrate them and things like that. Okay? Okay, so let me just make sure I didn't... there are a couple things that have to happen here. So let's get rid of the Bremsstrahlung. We're not talking about Bremsstrahlung, so I'll get rid of that again. First of all, the photon energy, at the very least, needs to be greater than 2 times the mass of the electron, or the rest mass of the electron, the rest energy. All right? In actual fact, there's another term here another term that goes as 1 over the mass of the nucleus, so it's very small. No, that's a mass, sorry. But for the most part, it's 2 times the rest energy of an electron. If, again, as I said, this photon is interacting with the nucleus. However, there can be a situation where, let's say, here's the nucleus, and here's an electron. Okay, I can draw a similar diagram. The electron. It's an electromagnetic interaction, so I can have the same process go on, not with this Z electrons here in the nucleus, Z protons here in the nucleus with charge plus Z, but with this one negatively charged electron here that I'm interacting with. The diagram looks fairly similar, but in this case, if this is the interaction that's happening, the energy of the photon needs to actually, if you go through it, be greater than 4 times the rest energy of the electron. Okay? So there is a little difference in the threshold, but for the same reasons that interacting with atomic electrons was small compared to interacting with the nuclei, it's the same here. And so this really is the main requirement. And when you look at the cross-section, you'll see that it starts somewhere a little above this value, which is a little more than 1 MeV. Okay? Okay. One rule of thumb that's useful is that when you have the photon and you produce these two particles, there's an opening angle between them. Now, remember that these electrons are very, very light. Okay, so in most lab situations, this photon energy will be well above this threshold. Okay, and so the lab frame will be very, very boosted with respect to the center of mass frame, center of momentum frame. And so this opening angle will certainly not be 180 degrees. It will be fairly small, and it goes approximately as, it goes approximately as the rest energy of the electron divided by the photon energy, okay? So it's pretty tiny. If you were thinking of a 1 GeV photon, then this opening angle is going to be on the order of a thousandth of a radian. I mean, it's going to be pretty tiny, okay? Okay. Okay, the next thing would be, let's take a look at the cross-section. So people have done calculations of the pair production cross-section in different cases. We've talked about screening before. So this is the case where you don't see the nucleus because you're far enough away that the electrons surrounding it screen the nucleus. Okay, so classically we think in terms of if we're at a large enough impact parameter, we are just going to see a neutral object. We're not going to have an electromagnetic interaction with it. But so if we cut off the calculation at some point, that's one way that people have done the calculation. Those calculations are usually valid in the case of pair production only in the situation where you have a very high energy photon. A case where you have a lower energy photon down to near where the threshold is you don't do anything with screening. You just assume there's no screening. And so one of the people that have done the calculation give us this form. This is the Z of the atoms in the material, in the medium that we're interacting with. This is the fine structure constant, the radius of the electron. You have this logarithmic term, which is dependent on the energy of the photon, H nu, okay? So, okay. And this 7/9 term is actually, basically, this is coming in basically from the flipping of the Feynman diagram, from the Bremsstrahlung diagram. So this is really, if we look at it a little further, you'll see this is really the only difference in terms of the total cross-section from the Bremsstrahlung cross-section. Other than that, this will end up looking quite similar. And the way that, well, I won't get to that in a second. Let me just elaborate on a couple things here. First of all, the first thing to note is that, so this, in this low, relatively low energy regime, is roughly proportional to the log of the photon energy, okay? So it will go up relatively slowly with photon energy. That won't, it turns out, continue forever, but so there is some increase. This term here, don't worry about it. It just comes out. There's also another small correction that I'm ignoring, which I think Ferno uses, which has to do with thinking in detail about the way the electrons are interacting with the field of the nucleus, and I don't include that. Those are fairly small. But the important thing is that this is going to increase gently with the photon energy. Now, as I said, this nucleus, there is some screening that will happen, and we can... there is some screening that can happen, and at high energy, one can take the approximation that at high impact parameter, there is complete screening of the nucleus. Okay, so there's really not complete screening, but so in that situation, let me do a couple things here. First of all, in this case, there is a limitation on where this is valid. So this is valid when the photon energy is between the rest energy of the electron and the rest energy of the electron divided by alpha times z to the third. This here corresponds to several. Alpha is 1 over 137. And this number is as high as 100, the third power of 100. So the biggest it could be is 5, okay, or 4. So really, yeah, 4 or so. So basically this here is on the order of approximately 20 or less. Okay? So this is basically the range of energies that that's valid. It is describing, it's most valid really in this region here, where you can see that most of the dependence on the pair production cross-section with energy is happening. And then you see that it starts to flatten out. So that part is where we can make the screening approximation I haven't really gotten to yet. But so this is an important, you know, just to give you a sort of basic idea of where that shape comes from. And you could see, if you extrapolated it down, it would come to somewhere just above about an MeV. And that's because of this energy threshold that I mentioned, which is roughly 2 times the electron mass. Okay? Okay, now, for high energy, one can essentially ignore the high impact. I mean, this is sort of what we mean by saying that we can take the completely screened approximation, is that when we're dealing with high energy, we're generally dealing with interacting with the nucleus at small distances. Okay. So there's always this inverse relationship between energy and distance. So as my energy goes up, I'm probing smaller and smaller distance scales. And so what's happening is that when I go up to higher and higher energy, I don't really care too much about the, you know, cross-section from with interacting with the nucleus when I'm a couple times the radius of the electron shell. Because even if the screening isn't complete, it doesn't matter. There's not enough cross-section there to matter. What really matters at these higher energies is that I'm now really getting inside the atom, I'm getting close to the nucleus, and I'm having interactions at a fairly close distance scale with the nucleus. Okay? So now that means that the photon, which is h nu, has an energy that's much greater than this same rest mass, rest energy of the electron divided by alpha z to the third. Okay, so that's just this part of this approximation. So this can take us up, you know, up into this region perhaps. Now we're going to be well above that. We're going to be way over here. Okay, we're going to be at a very high energy. And then, of course, whatever happens in between these two regions, one might just interpolate. The plot is showing you. But so when we have this condition, and we can ignore high-impact parameter interactions, you know, where the screening of the nucleus is very complicated, then we have the following. So it starts out looking similar to what I have over here, but it gets somewhat different. And in fact, you will probably recognize this one over 54 is not important, but you've seen this before, this z squared alpha r squared log of 183 times z to the minus 1/3. You've seen that before. You saw it before when we talked about what process? It was about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. You saw it before when we talked about Bremsstrahlung. It's okay. Okay? Now, this is not the Bremsstrahlung cross-section. It actually is 7/9 the Bremsstrahlung cross-section. Okay? So even though that diagram is flipped and in nature this process looks completely different than Bremsstrahlung, it's essentially described by the same thing. And by the time you get up to tens of MeV, just like with Bremsstrahlung, this is the cross-section that dominates. You don't, in the case of an electron interacting with matter, you stop worrying about ionization losses and things like that. You just worry about Bremsstrahlung. Here, you just, for photons, you just worry about pair production. Okay? Okay. The important aspects of this, there's two important aspects. First of all, this, which is true of that as well, of course, the cross-section is dependent on Z squared. So as I go to heavier elements, the cross-section will go up a lot. It will go up very rapidly. So that's one aspect. So this is proportional to Z squared. The other thing is that it's constant versus the photon energy. Nowhere in here does H nu or E gamma occur. Okay, so what that's saying is that if I were to go way to the right of this plot, the cross-section would essentially be flat in terms of energy. So if I were to take this and extrapolate it, I would end up with some logarithmic dependence, but what's being said is that it looks like this, and it just becomes some constant value at very high energy. Okay? And obviously in between these two we have something like that. When we talked before about Bremsstrahlung, we said, yes, most of the interaction is happening with the nucleus, and that's going at Z squared, but there is also an interaction with the atomic electrons. And that was going as some other power of Z. One. Okay? Right. So if I want to correct these expressions for the fact that there is some interaction going on with the atomic electrons, all you have to do is replace Z squared with Z times Z plus 1. Same as you did when we talked about Bremsstrahlung. Okay? Now, you don't replace this with anything. It's only where you have Z squared. Okay? And we're going to talk about the characteristic distance that pair production occurs. There's a Z squared there that you also would make this substitution. Okay? So what we can, the way I find it useful to think about is in terms of the Feynman diagram. Can I erase some of this? I only have two boards in front. Can I? Okay. For me, if I have a photon, That's the pair production cross-section that gives us this equation or that equation. That's the Feynman diagram. If I want to add the electrons, there's another drawing. That looks like that. Okay? Where this is Z protons and this is one electron. Okay? So it's the same. This is a charged object just like this, so it can exchange a virtual photon just as this one can, okay? And Many of the vertices are the same. It has very much similar aspect to it. There's only one electron here, whereas there's Z protons here. And that's essentially where that different expression comes from. Why it doesn't go from Z squared to 1 squared is more complicated. I don't have an easy... I've tried to think of a good way, but I don't. I would like to be able to explain better. Okay? Is that good? Any other question? Okay. Okay, I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so... all right, we can take this expression here, which at high energy is basically just the case, and we can think about, well, what is the characteristic length for E plus E minus production? If I have one photon interacting with matter, how far does it have to go before it has an interaction on average? So we can think about this really as the number density of atoms. So this is really the number of atoms per volume times the cross-section per atom. So this is the cross-section we just have over here, for instance. Okay? And this will equal (coughs) 7/9 times 4. And now I'll just include the atomic electron correction, Z times Z plus 1, Na, Re squared times alpha times the log of 183 over Z to the Z to the 1/3. Okay. If I was to go back to our discussion of Bremsstrahlung, you remember there was a characteristic distance in Bremsstrahlung, which was called the radiation length. Okay. Well, it turns out that this length is 9/7 of that length. If you look at the expression for radiation length, it's basically that without the 7/9 in it, or the 9/7, flipping it over. Okay? So this comes from our discussion of Bremsstrahlung. This comes from our discussion of pair production. And as I said, the Feynman diagrams are very similar. And so you see, to order of magnitude, they're very similar. There is a little difference, but not much. And what this means is that, just a little foreshadowing, when you have, say, an electron interacting with matter, it will, over chi naught, produce a Bremsstrahlung photon. That photon, in approximately another chi naught, will pair produce and produce an electron and a positron. In another of the same distance, they will each Bremsstrahlung, and in another distance, so you will have something. If you start with an electron, you end up with a photon and electron, then pair production, and Bremsstrahlung, okay? So you end up with every approximately every radiation length, you get a doubling because of the pair production, and you get a proliferation of electrons. Now you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 electrons or positrons. We don't care about the sign of the charge. So this is going to produce ionization. Right? These are charged objects. The photons won't, but these will. Now, if I were to make a photon, okay, what would a photon interacting with matter if it was a high-energy photon? Well, here, I'm going to have a photon, then it's going to pair produce, then these are going to bremsstrahlung, and then the photons are going to pair produce. Okay, so again, so it starts out looking completely different. I had an electron and I had a photon. But by the time I get here, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 electrons or positrons. Here, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have 1, 2, 3 photons. And here I have 1, 2 photons. Okay? So what happens is over time, these showers become, they're called showers, they become indistinguishable, okay? Because when I go to look, I look after several of these, and I just see a bunch of electrons. I see a bunch of ionization from the electrons. The difference between 11 electrons in this case and 12 in that case, I don't see that difference. So electrons and photons end up having a very similar behavior in material because of this analogy between the bremsstrahlung process and the pair production process. Okay? And the only other... Yeah, we're running out of time, so I won't go into it. I'll just say briefly. So the only other thing I wanted to say is that when you produce this E plus E minus, as I said, the you have a positron and you have an electron, and in general the positron or the electron, but let's say the positron, can end up with some fraction of the initial photon's energy. Okay? So I could have a situation where I have a photon with 100 GeV, it interacts with matter, and I produce an electron with 99 GeV and a positron with 1 GeV. I mean, that could happen. Okay? The question is there any preference to how much energy the electron or the positron get? Okay, is there any, you know, preference to that? So the Fernow has a nice description, and I just pointed out there is a parameter. It's called something different in each textbook, but called the partition parameter. So in Fernow, it's use the script G, and it's the energy of the positron minus the rest energy of an electron divided by the energy of the photon minus 2 times the rest energy. So here, this is the total kinetic energy available from the reaction. This is the kinetic energy of the positron. Okay? Because the positron's got the mass of an electron. So what fraction of that? And that's what's plotted here on the x-axis. And this is essentially, in funny units, the relative cross-section. And what you can see is it actually does depend. The positron or the electron either wants to have most or least of the energy, doesn't want to split the energy 50-50. But if you look at it a little broader, what you really see is that to within about 20% or 25%, this is flat. So in fact, to zeroth order, the energy that goes to the positron or the electron is random. Okay? And it goes almost all the way to 1 and 0. There's a better plot of this in Gruppen and Schwarz, for different photon energies because the shape changes a little bit. And but again, you'll see that it's fairly flat as you go up to those distances. Up to either 100% or 0%. Okay?